Good evening and welcome to Health Matters. I'm Dr. Sanford Katz and I'll be your host as we discuss medical controversies and health fads. 50% of Americans use some form of alternative medicine and 10% use it on their children, making it a $34 billion a year business. In 2010, a survey of 6,000 hospitals found that 42% offered some form of alternative therapies in response to patient demand. Many Americans seem to turn to alternative medicine. They go to their acupuncturist or chiropractor or naturopath to relieve pain. They subject themselves to colon cleansers and enemas to remove nonspecific toxins in their bodies. They take ginkgo biloba for memory or homeopathic remedies for the flu or megavitamins for energy and to optimize normal body functions and Chinese herbs for potency or Indian spices to boost their immune system. Some Americans use alternative medicine exclusively due to apparent distrust of conventional medicine, and some are even refusing to vaccinate their children, a standard universally accepted medical practice that dates back to 1796 when Edward Jenner, a country doctor working in southern England, found that he could protect people from smallpox by inoculating them with cowpox. By inducing the immunity that follows natural infection without actually having to suffer the disease itself, vaccines have dramatically reduced deaths and illness from a whole host of diseases. Tonight on Health Matters, we will be discussing some of these controversial issues and unconventional practices and addressing some of the potential merits and possible risks associated with them. Joining me this evening for our discussion are three special guests: Dr. Joseph Bocchini, Professor and Chairman of Pediatrics, Section of Pediatric Infectious Diseases, Department of Pediatrics at LSU Health Sciences Center here in Shreveport; Dr. Paul Jordan, Chief of the Section of Gastroenterology at LSU Health Sciences Center in Shreveport; and Gray Rogers, registered dietitian, a community weight loss dietitian here in Shreveport. Good evening and welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Well, to start off, I think the hot button topic you hear so much of these days is vaccines and whether we should or shouldn't be vaccinating our children and whether or not they're safe. Dr. Bocchini, can you explain what the current controversy regarding vaccines is all about?
Well, I think that it's very clear that vaccines are one of the best public health achievements that we have seen in the last 100 years. And it's very clear that vaccines reduce morbidity, they reduce mortality. And in fact, we currently immunize children against 16 different vaccine-preventable diseases that cause considerable morbidity and mortality. All of these can cause problems that lead to permanent disability and death.
So you're using the terms morbidity and mortality. Can you explain the difference?
Sure. Morbidity means that when you have an illness, you're left with some long-term problems that are a result of that illness. And for some vaccine-preventable diseases, it could be that the patient, because of, for example, measles, develops a swelling and inflammation around the brain. And when that happens, if the patient recovers, they may have some significant abnormal neurologic residual or long-term effects of the infection. Mortality is death.
I see.
And if we take measles, for example, one or two children for every 1,000 who develop measles will die. Measles is a very serious illness. So I think one of the problems is that right now vaccines have been so successful that parents don't see the illnesses that the vaccines prevent. So parents in some cases have turned to concerns about the vaccines and their side effects as opposed to paying attention to how severe the diseases that the vaccines prevent are and what the serious consequences are of having one of those vaccine-preventable diseases.
I see. Growing up, I actually knew people who had polio, and so we were reminded on a daily basis, you know, seeing these people, and I can't recall the last time I saw someone who had polio or any disability relating to polio. Is that the sort of thing you're talking about?
That's exactly right. When polio vaccine was first licensed, people lined up to have their children vaccinated all across the country because at that point in time, over 50,000 cases of polio were occurring each year in the United States, and parents feared polio, and they feared the consequences for their children. And you're right, since 1979, there hasn't been a case of polio in the United States. And so we have a generation of parents who don't see the consequences of polio, and so they may worry about the vaccine and the potential side effects that the vaccine may have.
I see. Now, you mentioned a whole host of diseases. Could you mention some of those diseases and describe exactly what are some of the morbidity, as you say, and the rates of mortality associated with those diseases that we currently vaccinate for?
Certainly. One of the ones that I've seen disappear during my career is Haemophilus influenza. This is a bacterial infection that caused a significant number of cases of meningitis in children. Each year in the United States, over 10,000 children would develop meningitis due to Haemophilus influenza. This meningitis resulted in about a 10% death rate, and about a third of the children who survived the meningitis ended up with neurologic problems, long-term problems with their ability to either walk or move around or be successful in school. Because of the development of a vaccine against Haemophilus influenza, there are fewer than 20 cases of Haemophilus influenza disease in the United States now. So this is a remarkable success story. And so as a resident, I treated many children that had meningitis due to Haemophilus influenza. Now we don't see that anymore. A second vaccine that was made the same way as the Haemophilus influenza vaccine is a vaccine against pneumococcus, Streptococcus pneumoniae. This is another very serious bacterial infection that can cause meningitis in children. And although we're focusing on children, it's important to remember that adults need vaccines too, that it's really important that adults get vaccinated. But for children, because they have developing immune systems, because it's the first time they're seeing certain infections, they often have more severe disease. So those would be two. Diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis was the first real vaccine that was developed as a combination vaccine. Protects against two very serious toxin-related diseases, diphtheria and tetanus. And pertussis, is a disease that kills children under 3 months of age. It's a very serious infection. And the highest mortality is in young children.
I see.
So there are many others. And actually, one I want to spend a second talking about, the most recent vaccine we've introduced is the vaccine against human papillomavirus. This is a remarkable advance. Human papillomavirus is now known to cause the majority of anogenital cancers. It's the only cause of cervical cancer. And it causes a number of oropharyngeal cancers of the mouth and throat. We now have a vaccine that will prevent up to 90% of HPV-related cancers. And so this is something that it's really important to get children vaccinated against before they get exposed.
I'm glad to hear you mention the fact that adults need to be vaccinated, too. I had a personal experience with failing to get my herpes zoster vaccine. And believe me, at the time when I got the disease, I wished I had had the vaccine.
Yes.
And it's a chickenpox.
Chickenpox.
Yeah. Right. Now, there's some controversy associated with that that HPV vaccine?
Well, I think HPV, there were a number of, and again, there's a fair amount of misinformation about vaccines and the side effects of vaccines. And I think that what happened in part with HPV vaccine was that there were some individuals who misinterpreted data that's submitted to a vaccine adverse event reporting system. So in other words, what we're asked to do as part of the safety system in the United States with the use of vaccines is report any event that occurs after a vaccine is given to a child or an adult. Now, we report that because if the FDA and the CDC see a large number of reports, that could trigger the development of a study to look to see if the vaccine is related to those events. Because we give vaccines to many million people each year, and sometimes an event's going to occur after the vaccine has been given that's not related to the vaccine. There are events that would have occurred whether the vaccine was given or not. And so we have to do hypothesis-driven studies to determine whether the side effect is related to the vaccine. In the case of HPV vaccine, there was some concern that some of the things that do normally happen to young children, adolescents, because we give this vaccine at age 11 to 12, were being caused by the vaccine. In fact, there are now a number of prospective studies. These are taking children who receive the vaccine and children who do not, and compare what happens afterwards. And there's been no serious side effect associated with HPV vaccine. So even though some concerns were raised by some individuals, the evidence is that the HPV vaccine is very safe.
I see. Now, some people are concerned about taking vaccines that they'll actually cause the disease. I hear that quite a bit, particularly with the flu vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
Could you speak about that a little bit, please?
Well, I think there's very good scientific evidence that influenza vaccine does not cause influenza. In fact, most people who get influenza vaccine get the killed vaccine, which is really a component of the organism. Although that may cause a sore arm and a little bit of discomfort, it really doesn't produce influenza. And again, this is a really good example of how things can get misinterpreted. There are a number of viral respiratory illnesses that are very common during the time that you're going to get influenza vaccine. And so that can be confused with an effect of the vaccine when, in fact, there's very good data that doesn't happen.
So what are the risks associated with taking vaccines?
Well, vaccines are very safe. Vaccines have been tested in clinical trials are done before the vaccine is licensed. So when a vaccine is first licensed, we know the common side effects that occur. And essentially, they may be local pain, swelling, redness at the injection site. Some vaccines cause fever. And then there are rarer side effects, so that there can be serious side effects to vaccines, but they're pretty rare. Like, for example, a very serious allergic reaction might occur in 1 in a million doses of vaccine, but it can happen. So we watch for that, and that's one of the things that we watch for. If a patient has a serious allergic reaction, then we don't want to give that vaccine again. So there are side effects, and they can be severe, but they're rare. And if you compare those rare side effects from the vaccine with the serious and common complications of the infection the vaccine is designed to prevent, mm-hmm. vaccines are much safer than being at risk for the natural infection.
So what is the impact to public health if someone decides not to have their children vaccinated?
Well, I think we saw the impact of that in the recent measles outbreak in Disneyland. If the vast majority of children who developed and adults who developed measles after that outbreak were unvaccinated individuals. And I think that what this tells us is that these vaccine-preventable diseases, many of them are still out there. And if we don't vaccinate and a number of individuals in the community are not immunized, then an outbreak can occur. So this is the downside. So if you, for example, believe that your child didn't need measles vaccine and you went to Disneyland and your child got exposed, your child not only got measles, but because of getting measles, had about a 1 or 2 children out of 1,000 will die of measles. 10% get admitted to the hospital because of complications. Most common complication is pneumonia. Second most common complication is brain swelling and inflammation, what we call encephalitis. So that's the danger. The danger is that you're leaving your child unprotected, and you're also leaving the community unprotected, because we need a large number of people in the community protected against a specific viral infection or bacterial infection to prevent those few children who can't get vaccinated or those few children who don't respond to vaccine to remain protected.
So there's really a herd type of protection,
right.
So that for
exactly.
those who are still susceptible,
right.
that there isn't actually active disease virus being shed around that they'll get exposed to. So really, when you're making the decision not to vaccinate your child, you're making a decision for other people's children as well as to whether or not they get exposed to and potentially contract the disease.
So that's correct.
Okay. So
correct.
Are vaccines are they mandatory? Are all these childhood vaccines mandatory, or do parents have the choice?
Well, a number of vaccines are mandated for school entry. And in many cases, they're mandated for daycare entry as well. And so what we would like is that children receive age-appropriate immunization before they are with a larger group of children so that they are protected, and then that group of children is protected as well. There are every state has a number of laws that would require school entry or daycare entry immunization. Many states also have opt-out options where for religious reasons or philosophical reasons you could choose not to have your child immunized.
So philosophical reasons, that could, seems very broad.
It's very broad, and every state has a different interpretation of that. In some cases, it's relatively easy for parents to say they don't want the vaccine. In other states, it requires them to really learn about the illness that the vaccine prevents, and then have a discussion with their provider, and then sign a document that indicates that they've chosen not to have their child immunized.
And how are we doing in Louisiana in terms of vaccination rates?
Well, overall, the vaccination rate in Louisiana is good. We're in the low 90s for children who are at about 18 months to 3 years of age, and we reach about 98% for children entering school.
Okay, so I suppose that we need to move into the controversy now that you hear so much about, now that we know a little bit about the vaccines and their safety and the impact they have on public health. Can you talk a little bit about specifically the MMR vaccine, the concerns about the MMR vaccines and the potential association some people believe it has with autism?
Well, MMR vaccine is measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. It's a combination vaccine. It's a live attenuated vaccine, and it's given to children at about 12 to 15 months of age. Unfortunately, the time that parents will often recognize that their children has autism is around the same time period, because that's when the symptoms of autism really become apparent. So it's easy to understand why a parent who has their child immunized with MMR vaccine would then, if the child subsequently within the next month or so is recognized as having autism, to consider that the vaccine might be responsible for it, because it happened right before the symptoms were recognized. However, a large number of studies, multiple countries, epidemiologic studies, a whole series of studies have shown that measles vaccine, MMR vaccine, are not associated with the development of autism. So we have strong, yeah, very strong scientific evidence that that's the case. Unfortunately, a pediatric gastroenterologist in England, Andrew Wakefield, published an article in Lancet a number of years ago in which he studied a very selected group of children, approximately 12 children,
yeah,
who had autism, whose parents thought that the vaccine might be related to the development of autism. He studied those patients and then reported the possibility that measles vaccine was responsible, and suggested that the measles vaccine be separated from mumps and rubella and not be given until a child is 6 years of age. There was really no scientific evidence,
right,
to support that,
right,
recommendation.
It's a hypothesis.
Since that time, however, it's been shown that the data that he presented was inaccurate, and that, in fact, the children in that study were referred to him by lawyers who were interested in suing the manufacturer for the possibility that the autism these children had were related to the vaccines that they received. That article subsequently been retracted. All of the co-authors have said that they have removed their names from the article, and actually Dr. Wakefield lost his license to practice medicine in England based on the inaccuracies and the fraud that was associated with that article.
But not before receiving over $700,000 from law firms, I understand.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And unfortunately, this led to a resurgence of measles in England, so that there was a significant reduction in parents who allowed their children to have measles vaccine, and measles came back and caused a significant amount of disease.
I want to let our listeners know that your calls, comments, and questions are welcome at 800-552-8502. Dr. Jordan, Dr. Bocchini mentioned that it was a gastroenterologist, Dr. Wakefield, in England. And my understanding is he said that he noticed some changes in the GI tract of affected children with autism. And I understand that there's some question as to whether there are, in fact, differences. Can you speak a little about that from your experience?
I haven't seen any differences in the GI tracts of kids with autism. I actually have a grandson who has autism, so I have a particular interest in it as well. But I don't think there's anything different physically in these kids. It's a socialization thing, and it's a very serious and very interesting phenomena that requires very careful attention.
I see. So, now, you're a gastroenterologist. Could you explain exactly what that is?
A gastroenterologist is a guy who's interested and does diseases involving the esophagus, stomach, and duodenum, as well as the small bowel and then the colon, so the gut itself, and liver and pancreas. So it's a subspecialty of the underlying specialty of internal medicine.
And what kind of procedures do you perform?
We look in with scopes to the upper and lower GI tract. We do procedures involving the pancreas and the liver, and basically treat diseases that affect those organs.
I see. So if something was going on in a colon, you would actually be able to visualize it and see it?
Most of the time, you can see what's going on. Things, you may see inflammation, tumors, polyps, that sort of stuff. But there's also a disease called irritable bowel syndrome in which the colon actually looks absolutely completely normal. The biopsies are normal, but in fact the colon doesn't react normally to what are otherwise ordinary stimuli, such as food, chemicals, stress, so on.
So one of the hypotheses is that the colon and abnormal digestion may have a role to play in the development of autism. And I understand that there have been some restrictive diets that have been tried, casein-free, gluten-free. In what situations should somebody avoid gluten? It seems to be almost a health scare at this point that people are avoiding gluten. Is this something we should be concerned about in the general population? Who should avoid gluten?
Well, there's only one group of people that really need to avoid gluten, and they need to avoid it absolutely. They need to avoid every single drop of gluten, every molecule of gluten, and that's the people who have celiac disease. Celiac disease is an immune-mediated disease that affects the gut. It affects the small bowel and its ability to absorb things, and so people become iron deficient, vitamin deficient, calcium deficient, magnesium deficient. They can impair growth and development, and they can get diarrhea. But it's a very, very specific immune-modulated disease.
And what percentage of the population has?
Well, interestingly enough, years ago, we thought that about 1 in 4,000 people had it, and we thought it was mostly from the northern parts of Europe and people who had their heritage from those northern parts of Europe. But today we know that in America it's 1 in 137 people. We know that it's present in all races. We know that, and we never thought that before. We know that it's present, for example, we had a visiting professor from the Punjab in India, and it's a very common disease in the Punjab in India. We had no idea about that until this guy visited. It's also now been described in Gujarat, which is again in northern India. So it's basically a worldwide disease process. Now, in addition to people with celiac disease who must absolutely and very diligently avoid gluten, there are people who put themselves or take a relatively gluten-free diet with the idea that it makes them feel better. There are people who take it with the idea of losing weight and so on and so forth. It's interesting, there may be a way in which the genetically modified wheat, where the gluten comes from, that may actually have a a way of producing a little bit more gas than we normally have. But otherwise, we see no other effects from it. Whereas in celiac disease, we see antibody formation. That is, the immune system is actually activated, and it's the immune system that does it. And in order to have celiac disease, it looks like you have to have very specific genetic makeup, HLA DQ2 or DQ8. And people who don't have that genetic makeup will not develop celiac disease.
I see. We have a listener texting in a question and a statement, and that is that, and I wasn't aware of this number, apparently the CDC reports that less than 20% of Louisiana males get the HPV vaccine. And I understand it's now now recommended for both males and females. And as a radiation oncologist who treats those oropharyngeal cancers, even though men cannot get cervical cancer, it is becoming increasingly the cause of head and neck cancers, and so it is important that that both boys and girls get this vaccine.
Yes. Yeah, that's a really a good comment. If we look at the data for girls, it's only 56% in this state as well. So this is why I think this is one of the most important messages for the listeners, is that if there's a child who is 11 to 12 years of age, this is one of the vaccines that they need to get. There are over 20,000 cases of HPV-related cancer in the United States each year. This vaccine should be able to prevent 90% of them. And the vaccine is licensed up to age 26. So it is really an important vaccine. And Louisiana has one of the highest cervical cancer rates in the country.
Absolutely. Yeah, I see that in my practice. Again, the number for your calls, questions, comments, 800-552-8502. Gray, could you speak a little bit about the gluten-free diet from your perspective and what you're seeing? What are people trying to achieve? And even if you don't have celiac disease, are there some secondary benefits from going gluten-free?
Absolutely. Gluten-free is definitely becoming more and more popular, and I agree with what Dr. Jordan was saying. If you have celiac, you absolutely need to avoid it. But I know some people that have tried going gluten-free to, help relieve mucus or coughing and things like that. And there have even been some recent diet books that have talked about, they basically blame wheat for putting on excess belly fat and things like that. But I think if you ask a lot of people that go on gluten-free diets, they don't even know what gluten is or where it's coming from. Gluten is a protein that's found in wheat, rye, and barley, and it can be found in contaminated oats. But if you get certified gluten-free oats, then those are good. But
are there any grains that are gluten-free?
Well, things like rice is gluten-free.
Corn.
Corn, yes. Corn. I forget that's technically a grain.
Quinoa.
Quinoa.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What about beer? Is beer gluten-free?
No. Beer is made, it has wheat and barley included in that whole fermenting process. They do make beer and ciders from things.
There are gluten-free beers. Uh-huh. I've had them.
Yeah. Okay.
They're pretty tasty.
Thank goodness. Okay. We're talking public.
Yeah, there are gluten-free beers, and actually spirits are gluten-free as well.
Okay.
So that there are, but the problem that celiacs run into is that there are gluten in other things like lip gloss,
or
crayons,
soy sauce, or weird
sorts of things have gluten in them that would have no suspicion are there, and the celiac patient has to be very, very careful about what they contact that may have gluten. Cross contamination can be a problem.
Absolutely.
If you, for example. Let's say you have a celiac patient who eats meat off a grill that has grilled hamburgers and the buns have been on it. There's enough gluten can get them to create and trigger the immune reaction. So being absolutely, totally gluten-free.
Now, are there neurologic disorders or headaches or any other disorders or symptoms that can be associated with a sensitivity to gluten, even if you don't have specifically celiac disease?
None that I know of.
Okay.
I don't know of any. I've seen speculations about, it leads to depression and anxiety and weight gain and a whole host of various things, but I haven't really seen any strong evidence to support that.
I haven't seen any evidence at all to support that.
Okay. And are there any other current diet fads or movements that you'd like to talk about? Paleo is one that comes to mind.
Certainly. Paleo, and for listeners that may not be familiar with paleo, that's basically the caveman diet. This requires the dieter to cut out all grains and dairy, and it really ramps up the animal protein. So living like a caveman, some of the benefits are that you're cutting out the junk food. Some people may have an intolerance to dairy and not realize it, so cutting that out may make them feel a little better. And then high protein can help with increased satiety and help you not feel quite so hungry, make you not crave sweets and things like that. But there are certainly some drawbacks. The protein requirements on a paleo diet are 3 times as high as the normal recommendations for protein, which is pretty outrageous. Eating that much protein, it produces a lot of acid and can put strain on the kidneys. You'd really have to eat a lot of produce to mitigate that acid.
I see.
You know, Dr. Katz, one of the interesting things to me has always been that most animals will eat one kind of thing. They will eat leaves or grains or meat or something like that. But we humans, we eat anything we come within 100 yards of. And our body somehow has evolved to be able to adjust to all of those things. I mean, the amount of stuff that we put in our mouths and eat that goes through our GI tract is amazing.
Yes.
That we seem to tolerate it remarkably well.
Now, one thing that animals do that most humans don't is they eat organic food, seemingly, except unless, of course,
you get it from
the store. Yeah, unless yeah. they are the pets. So could you speak a little bit about organic versus, I guess, non-organic or all natural? What are the differences between these?
Yeah, well, natural, if you see that on a label, that's not a regulated term. Anybody can put that on a label. It really doesn't mean anything. But as far as organic versus non-organic, there's a lot of controversy over this. And actually, going back to the autism topic that we were talking about earlier, I came across some studies that found that maternal and paternal exposure to pesticides before and during pregnancy has been linked to autism, and that women that get pregnant and live within a few miles of traditional farming operations where they use pesticides and herbicides are more likely to have an autistic child. So I don't know. I think that's certainly something to be considered, since we're all trying to find something to blame for this autism epidemic.
Well, again, the problem now is that we're realizing that autism is so much more common than we thought it was 25, 30, 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so we now realize that, one in 133 kids
right.
have a form of autism or are on the autism spectrum. When my grandson was born with autism, my question was, gosh, you know, what happens to these kids as they grow up and get older? And I started to look around, and I realized that they become doctors and lawyers and scientists, and they contribute a lot to the world. Now, they have a little trouble with social interaction, but no, they're amongst us. They're our colleagues.
But you're talking about people on the autistic spectrum.
On the spectrum,
and
sure.
And, of course, some are more profoundly affected than others.
Indeed, yeah.
So that brings me, that's an interesting point that you were talking about with the pesticides. I came across one theory that some of the specific pesticides may, in fact, be the residual may in fact be getting into our GI tract, that it's on the plants, it's on the vegetables, and that while these pesticides, particularly Roundup, may not have an impact upon humans, that it can impact our normal gut flora and somehow influence the amino acids and other things that are created in our gut. I don't know if that's been proven or if that's a theory. Dr. Jordan, do you have
I don't know of any evidence to that effect.
Okay. So in addition to organic or inorganic, are those are regulated terms?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
Regulated by the USDA.
So is it fair to assume that if you're buying organic foods or meats, that there shouldn't be any pesticides or hormones in them, or can there still be some amount of pesticides?
When it comes to produce, as far as I know, if it's organic, then it's only been sprayed with organic pesticides or things that are certified organic. But when it comes to like packaged products, the ingredients, they require that 95% of the ingredients be organic. So you're going to get some non-organic products there. But with meats and things, it's a little tricky. As far as I know, organic meats are organic, but they're, I don't know, it gets a little tricky when it comes to, you know, not raised with antibiotics or free range or some of these other terms that they try to use to trick consumers into thinking that it's a healthier animal
product. Are there nutritional differences between organic and non-organic foods?
Produce, no. I haven't seen any studies that can confirm that. But for animal products, cows and chickens and things, well, specifically cows that are fed a grass-fed diet, mm-hmm. cows are meant to eat grass. They're better able to process that, and they actually produce meat that has a healthier fat distribution, more omega-3s. There's less inflammation and stress mm-hmm. whenever they're alive, basically, and that does translate into a healthier product.
Okay, so I wanted to remind our listeners once again that there's one call now. 800-552-8502 is the number to call in with a question or comment. So you mentioned omega-3s. There seems to be a very big industry of selling supplements, vitamins, antioxidants, herbal supplements. Can you speak a little bit as to the benefit of megavitamins, supplements, antioxidants? Is that something you recommend to your clients?
Typically, no. I don't take a multivitamin. I don't recommend that any of my clients take multivitamins. There's really not any good evidence for that. If you go to your doctor and you get blood work and they find that there is definitely a deficiency, vitamin D or whatever it may be, and you get a legitimate supplement to take care of that with the right dosage, then that's appropriate. And there is an organization, I believe it's called the USP, and they basically validate supplements and make sure that it's legitimate, that it contains the ingredients that it's supposed to contain, because supplements aren't regulated. They're not regulated by the FDA. We don't know what's in them. Some of these things have been tested and they don't contain what the label says that they contain. They contain some other harmful ingredients. So you really have to be careful when you just, you know, willy-nilly go into a health food store and start buying supplements.
So the supplements are not regulated. Now, when I'm looking at some of these labels, it seems as though they're making health claims, but then in the very fine print at the bottom, they say that this is not, we cannot make any claim, it's not regulated by the FDA, you know, and it's not indicated to treat, prevent, or manage any specific disease or condition. But yet, it seems a little contrarian, because it seems like they are, in fact, making some health claims. So they're not regulated, and you don't know what you're getting.
Correct.
So are they safe?
It really just depends. It's hard. I mean, it's really a gamble whenever you're taking supplements. You don't know if there's some sort of contaminant. Some may be good, some may be bad, but there's really no way of knowing. So it's hard to say.
Okay, the phones have just lit up, and we're going to go to a caller. All right, the first one is Rick from Shreveport. Rick?
Hi,
welcome to Health Matters. What's your question for our panel this evening?
Hi, I agree that vaccines have probably been the greatest thing to ever happen to human medicine and saving lives. My question is, they haven't had any greatest hits lately. And what are the future diseases that may be, tackled by vaccines? And more importantly, I guess the biggest threat on the horizon is the fact that we don't have a lot of good antibiotics left or future antibiotics. The drug companies don't seem to want to invest in them right now. And is any hope for vaccines to different, vaccines are for antivirals mainly, but what is the future there for stopping some of these MRSA viruses and some of these horrible things that we're afraid of going forward? Thank you.
That's a very good question. Thank you very much, Rick, for your call. Dr. Bocchini, what do you think about Rick's question in terms of where the future is going?
Well, I think it's a very important question. There are a number of of evolving or emerging infections that we really need to focus on that could be potentially dangerous. Obviously, Ebola is one, and actually with the Ebola outbreak that is now getting under control in West Africa, there is a clinical trial of a vaccine against Ebola. So hopefully we'll have some information related to that in terms of effectiveness. There are a number of respiratory pathogens that are still very serious problems for children, and they're under study now. There's a respiratory syncytial virus, parainfluenza virus. Those are two very important infections for which vaccines would be very beneficial for children.
My youngest daughter had RSV. It was very scary, and she now still suffers from pulmonary problems relating to that.
That's a very important complication. And RSV is the most common reason why a child would get admitted to the hospital under 1 year of age with respiratory disease, pneumonia, and bronchiolitis. But as to what the caller said, MRSA is a very serious bacterial infection. It's a Staph aureus infection with specific antibiotic resistance capacity. And there have been attempts to develop a vaccine against Staph aureus. They have not yet been successful. There are attempts to develop vaccines against some of the other viral pathogens that are very important. Human cytomegalovirus would be one. Herpes simplex is another. So I think there are a number of vaccines being considered in the pipeline against a variety of different infectious diseases. And the caller's also right. We're running out of antibiotics. We have resistance to virtually every antibiotic that we use related to a number of organisms that are becoming more difficult to treat. Some of these are in hospitals, and so we have to be very careful how we use antibiotics, to use them, we're calling this judicious use of antibiotics, so that they're only used in specific circumstances where they're beneficial.
I see. Dr. Jordan?
I think that the caller was mentioning they hadn't had any big hits recently, but indeed we have. Hepatitis C is eminently treatable today and was not as little as 3 or 4 years ago. The treatments were ineffective, they were very hard on the patient, and just in the last few months we've gotten new treatments for hepatitis C that are 95% to 97% cure rates, and very few side effects from these. The unfortunate thing is they're a little on the expensive side, but the point is the drug companies have come up and have run some really good studies and have come up with good treatments for hepatitis C. There's no vaccine yet for hepatitis C, and that's under development as well. But there are other things that need to be having vaccines too. HIV is one of them that I think about. But hepatitis C is just rampant, and now we have a way of curing it. The problem with hep C, of course, is that some of these people develop cancers of the liver, and that's a very, very fatal condition.
Okay, well, we have another caller. We have Michael from Bossier. Good evening, Michael. Welcome to Health Matters. What's your question for our panel?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm 46, I'm male. I don't really drink, I don't smoke anymore. And 3 or 4 times in the last couple of years, I'll wake up in the middle of the night with those cramps that you just cannot go back to sleep from. When I get in the bathroom, it is usually... it's a long time, and it starts out hard, and it ends up with a very soft stool. I usually end up throwing up from it, but the weird thing is I get like allergic reactions. My eyes swell, my throat swells. I'm not asking to be diagnosed with a phone. I guess what I'm asking is this just something that can happen sometimes, or is it something that I need to get checked out?
I think I can answer that. You need to be checked out.
By a... Perhaps a primary care physician, and then possibly a gastroenterologist.
Yeah, I think he should be referred to a gastroenterologist.
I would discourage you from going to a chiropractor to address a gastrointestinal problem such as this. And since we are talking about alternative and controversial health care, I wanted to try to encourage listeners, if they have a question regarding supplements or other questions regarding some conventional treatments that are currently in controversy, to give a call at 800-552-8502. And we have another caller. We have Paul from Shreveport. Paul, welcome to Health Matters.
Thank you.
What's your question for our panel?
Oh, okay. Yes, I grew up, I was born in 1960, now 55. I praised vaccinations because when I was young in the 60s, I remember, you know, many more cases of measles and polio, but neither here nor there. I was wondering if anyone could recommend a good website, because I was saying that so many vaccinations I'm really unaware of that are very helpful for adults and aging persons. If you know of a good website where I could just really check things out.
So that's a good, very good question. There are a number of websites on the internet that give significant misinformation, false information about vaccines. The one website that provides you with reliable information and would answer the questions about what an adult would need would be the Centers for Disease Control website, cdc.gov. And they have a number of pages of information related to various vaccines. They have vaccine schedule. They have a series of information pages that would be very helpful to you.
Well, thank you very much for the information, and this is a great program. Thanks again.
Oh, thank you very much for your call. We now have Jody from Shreveport. Jody, welcome to Health Matters. What's your question for our panelists?
Hey, I came in a little bit late, but I heard you talking about that multivitamins really have no benefit. And my question was about omega, because I thought omega was proven to have some mental health benefit when it comes to, you know, just improving awareness and not being so forgetful.
Gray, what do you know about omega?
I have seen quite a bit of evidence supporting omega-3s and how they're good for the brain and all of that sort of thing. But recently, though, I think a study just came out showing that that may not be accurate. I didn't actually read the study. I had a colleague of mine tell me about it. So, again, it's hard to say. Another concern is that some of these omega-3 supplements have some heavy metal contamination, and that could be a concern if you're not getting it from, a good quality company. Maybe looking for an omega-3 that's certified by that USP that I was talking about. That may be something that could help validate and make sure you're taking a quality supplement.
Okay, thank you very much for your question. We now have Regina from Alexandria. Regina, welcome to Health Matters. Regina? Okay. Regina?
Yes.
Yes, welcome to Health Matters. What is your question for our panel this evening?
I'm curious if they could speak to probiotics.
Excellent.
Yes.
Okay, who wants to field that? Gray or maybe Dr. Jordan?
I don't use probiotics. I don't take them. I don't use them. I don't give them to my grandchildren. I don't give them to my wife or family. There are gastroenterologists who believe that probiotics do things. I'm just not one of them.
What are they exactly, probiotics?
A probiotic is a bacteria that is, the idea is that it grows up inside your gut and that it then gives you protection against whatever you happen to think is evil and ill. I don't think that it has any place, although, there are gastroenterologists who tend to go ahead and use these.
And I'll chime in as well. With these probiotics, again, these supplements are not regulated, so sometimes they look at these, you know, look at actually what's inside of these capsules, and it's just dead bacteria. You're just, you know, blowing $50 a bottle on an expensive probiotic that's not doing anything. I think if somebody wanted to look into probiotics or start, you know, adding this healthy bacteria back to their gut, it'd be better to do it through fermented foods like sauerkraut. That's something that naturally ferments, has its own healthy bacteria, a variety of bacteria that's alive that you can ingest to help sort of regulate that gut flora. I don't know if
For many years, people have used yogurt and so on when they get diarrhea, and I don't think it has any great value other than it tastes good.
Okay, and we have another caller from Nacogdoches. Oh, by the way, thank you very much, Regina, for your question. We now have Jenny from Nacogdoches. Jenny, welcome to Health Matters.
Thank you. I had a question about autoimmune diseases. It seems, I know this isn't exactly the program that you're doing, but it seems that we seem to see a lot more of them, like you do with so many other things. My husband has Sjogren's, and my daughter was recently diagnosed with celiac, and she's coming up, she's about 40, and she's coming to see me this weekend, and I'm a little concerned about what to feed her. And I just wondered if you had any thoughts on why we're seeing so many new autoimmune diseases nowadays, or is it just we're better able to diagnose them, or is there some reason?
Yeah, thank you very much. That's an excellent question. You know, I will tell you that I've looked in this myself, and one of the things that I found it was suggested is that we're inundated with all sorts of chemicals. We have preservatives, perhaps fragrances. There's a lot of artificial colors and whatnot in our environment, which I don't know if there's a definitive answer to your question, but it does raise the question. There's a lot of discussion about toxins. What are these toxins? Are they in our body? How do we get them out? And that brings me to the something that these whole colon cleanses and detox regimen. So perhaps this might help address a little bit of this with you. But thank you very much for your call. For Dr. Jordan, what are your thoughts of these colon cleansers and these detox regimens, and how would they work? I'm trying to understand how evacuating your bowels completely would extract toxins, and I'm not exactly certain what those specific toxins are, but how that could extract toxins from your kidneys and your liver and your lungs and your skin.
It's just total nonsense. No one can explain. It's total nonsense.
So, I've heard on television that people carry around 10 pounds of excess waste stuck to their colon. Now, you seem to be intimately familiar with the colon.
I spend my days in the colon.
You spend your day up in the colon.
I live in the colon.
Do you see any of these, stuck on waste or toxins?
No. Colons are just got poop in them. It's not a big deal. And this thing where you see it on TV with, 10, 15, 20 pounds of stuff that is stuck on the walls and has been there for 40 years, it's just total nonsense.
So you're not a fan of you don't recommend colon cleanses to your patients?
No, not particularly.
You know, one of the toxins that I have come across is food dyes. And there seems to be some evidence to suggest that these food dyes may cause neurologic issues. They may cause hyperactivity in children. And some of them are shown to even cause cancer. And so there have been some petitions to the FDA to regulate or even eliminate some of these food dyes. We were talking about these detox regimens. I did come across a particular detox regimen sold by GNC. And what was interesting about it, I won't give the specific name, but it did say that the daily toxic buildup may cause damage to our organs and start to affect our general health and well-being. And this particular detox regimen scours the body of unwanted pollutants and are guaranteed to provide satisfaction and reliability. Well, basically, some of the instructions that they offer along with taking this is to urinate frequently to expel these toxins, which I think is involuntary anyway, and to avoid these unwanted toxins in the first place. But what was interesting to me is that when I looked at the ingredients, it included FDNC red dye number 40, which is a synthetic, it's a dye derived from petroleum, and in fact it's on the list of dyes that people are trying to get, scientific groups are trying to get eliminated. So it seems to me that this particular detox regimen that you can buy at GNC contains the very toxins that we should be avoiding. And I think the take-home message that I got in preparing for the show is that, as Gray mentioned numerous times, that these regimens are not regulated. We don't know what's in them, and they're not inert. And in fact, one of the things that I found was that they can interact with medicines that people take. Blood thinners, diabetes medicine, anti-seizure medicines. And so I think one of the things that seems to be clear from our discussion today is that that many of these things are unproven and potentially can be unsafe. And so with any of these alternative medicines or supplements, I think it's important to discuss them with your doctor.
I think it's very important. I think that they are actually very dangerous in some ways. There is more money spent, for example, on alternative medicine than there is on legitimate medicine in this country every year. I've had patients who have died from supplements.
The other thing that people need to be aware of is if they're on other medications, that these supplements might interfere with the metabolism of those medications. They might interfere with the absorption of them. So it's really important to talk to your physician if you are choosing to do that, to get some advice and to make sure that your physician knows what else you're taking.
As a cancer doctor, I advise my patients not to take antioxidant treatments during therapy because they can, in fact, inhibit the effectiveness of the cancer treatment. And interestingly, there were a number of studies that were performed in smokers, people at high risk of developing lung cancer, where they looked at beta-carotene and some other antioxidants and, in fact, found repeatedly that there were increased, even higher rates of lung cancer developing in the people who took the antioxidants and higher rates of death. So these things are not inert. I think we have time for just one more quick caller. Jason from Shreveport. Where are we here? Jason, welcome to Health Matters.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a quick question. So a lot of people, as was kind of mentioned earlier, are going online to do their own research and kind of look up different things about, you know, health effects and stuff like that. And someone mentioned earlier that there's obviously some good websites out there that are great resources, but there's also a lot that are not credible, that provide a lot of misinformation. And so is there any, like, advice or tips you could give to the layperson to be able to distinguish, like, what's a good website that's good information versus not?
That is a really great question.
Very good question.
And I think what we all have to remember is that the Internet is a tribute to the First Amendment of our Constitution.
Dr. Bucchini?
I would say that I would look for websites that the trusted websites would be those that come from professional organizations, health organizations for children. The American Academy of Pediatrics website is very helpful, has accurate information. Mayo Clinic has a website. I mean, there are a number of very well-recognized healthcare groups that have websites, and I would use those. I'd use the CDC because I think that's where you're going to get accurate, scientifically based, evidence-based information about health needs.
For inflammatory bowel disease, the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation has a website, ccfa.org.
And the American Dietetic Association, or the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, now also has some good health information about diet and whatnot.
Perfect. I want to thank all of my guests this evening. Gray, I want to thank you very much. Dr. Bocchini, Dr. Jordan, I really appreciate all of you being here and providing such fantastic and very informative advice to our listeners. Though it is important to know that Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or health professional. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran, with production assistance provided by Kermit Poling and Henry Edwards. Production of Health Matters is made possible in part by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and also by the Gables at Spring Lake, Gamble Guest Care's assisted living community located behind Spring Lake Guest Care Center on Line Avenue in Shreveport. Learn more about gambleguestcare.com. Join us next Thursday for our mental health edition of Health Matters. The topic will be romance. I'm Dr. Sanford Katz. Good evening.